This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Shortly after the jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri, comedian Chris Rock tweeted this. I just found a new app to tell you which one of your friends is racist. It's called Facebook. The joke hit home for many Twitter and Facebook users. Reasonable people who would avoid topics like the grand jury decisions in Ferguson or Staten Island or immigration or the Gaza conflict at the holiday dinner table wound up in the middle of bitter exchanges and unfriendings over these issues on Facebook. WNYC's New Tech City podcast recently aired some personal stories along with some practical advice on what to do when your friend on Facebook says something racist. And host Manoush Zamarodi is with us to talk about it. Manoush, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
Manoush, let's begin. You put together a little montage of people affected by this issue. Let's hear from them.
My story is that I had a friend that I worked with.
I recently had a dialogue on Facebook with a friend of mine about immigration and executive orders.
One of my elementary school friends who I grew up with posted a story about hair salons accepting EBT cards.
And it just got really uncomfortable because the posts he was making were about Hispanic people, and I am married to a Hispanic man.
And some of her friends started to chime in, and they made fun of African Americans on the way that they spoke and how they were going to get their hair did.
A friend of theirs, whom I didn't know, interjected a picture. And this was a photo of our current president.
By the time they got to the whole Chinaman thing and doing the nails, I just said, you know what, this is just too much for me.
A noose was photoshopped in, so now it looks like someone's putting a noose around his neck, and it was entitled, "Hope on a Rope, It's What Everyone's Been Waiting For."
Now, I no longer see racist comments on my Facebook page because I deleted my Facebook page.
So a couple things come up for me here, Manoush, starting with why these kinds of offensive messages turn up on Facebook. You know, it's not fully anonymous like internet trolling. These are family, they're colleagues, they're people you went to school with.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? Some of them you know incredibly well, very intimately. Other people are sort of people you met once. Maybe you thought you clicked, and so you friended each other. And yet, Facebook has become a place where people feel that they are sort of anonymous because they don't have to look anyone in the eye to say something like this. And once one comment, maybe it's not explicit, but sort of has an undertone of racism or sexism or classism or whatever it might be, people just sort of go with it. A lot of people either they decide, you know what, I'm not going to listen to this, and they unfriend it, like the woman you heard, Tamika Cody. Or maybe they just think, oh, this is normal, and it becomes normal, and it becomes part of the feed, and no one really stops or does anything about it.
Well, I hear from them, as I've heard from people that I know, an element of surprise or unawareness that one of your friends or even your aunt or uncle or somebody might post something that's so offensive.
Well, it's shocking, right? Because, like you say, it's not something that would come up in polite conversation. And yet, when things get heated, when it comes to politics, when it comes to racial discussion, people say things that maybe they wouldn't say at the dinner table. And yet, so I think that's what we found, Virginia, was that people were struggling. They were surprised. They were shocked. And they also didn't know what to do because on the one hand, you don't want to deal with that. But on the other hand, if you unfriend someone, doesn't that just make your Facebook feed or whatever social media you're on, if you unfriend people or stop following people who think differently than you do, surely that makes it a more homogenous feed. I mean, we know that, I think there's a study that came out that said for white people, most of them, 91% of their social circle is also white. 83% for black Americans, they average a social circle that's 83% black as well. So we know it's a pretty homogenous group that we put around ourselves in real life. And so, you know, we actually asked Facebook, do you know what the racial composition is of Facebook, of people on Facebook? And they told us that they don't track the racial composition of people's friends on the social network in any way. But they did tell us that in the 24 hours after the Ferguson grand jury decision, 11 million people had 33 million interactions about Ferguson on Facebook. It's a lot of interaction, a lot of ideas, thoughts, opinions flying around really fast. Maybe people not thinking totally through how they should put perhaps a somewhat divisive comment forward, or just not thinking at all.
Well, you brought up so many interesting things, but I remember seeing a study, now this was from last year, finding that Facebook is a particularly powerful medium to spread racist messages. Why is that?
Oh, yeah. So we talked to Shannon Rao. She's a social psychologist at Benedictine University in Illinois. She did a really interesting study where she created a fake Facebook guy, white guy, and she sent it out to several hundred people. She sent three different messages. So one of the messages was, you know what, we still have a long way to go with discrimination. Another message was overtly racist about white supremacy. You know, at first, participants agreed with that first message, and they really rejected the overt racist message. You know, so that's a relief, right? But then she sent out a third message, and this third message, they called it the victim message. And in this message, the writer talked about why whites are the most oppressed group in America today. Now, so it wasn't, you know, as overt or nasty. It was sort of a different angle, and they found a very high level of agreement with the message, particularly among people who use Facebook very frequently, who really use it to be part of a community. So, you know, wedged between sports scores and gossip, the sort of less obviously racist message wasn't flagged. People just kind of went with it. And Shannon Rao's point is subtle and just not saying anything. That's actually very powerful when no one flags something, when they just let it go by, when they let it seem normal. I also particularly found it interesting that it was the people who spend a lot of time on Facebook who were the most likely to agree with it, not the person who sort of pops on occasionally to get some information. And you know, and it made me depressed because it made me wonder if finding a community online can mean losing the ability to think critically. You know, that was the sort of worry that I have. Yes, it's depressing that we do create a homogenous society for ourselves off and online. But then, so surely a place that could be more sort of racially diverse, you know, online, we're not doing that, and we're sort of letting things slide as well. And that was, you know, our listeners really wanted help with, like, so what do I do? Like, how do I cope with this? Do you just, like,
well, yeah, because
it or not.
Because if people don't let it slide, I mean, well, here are the choices, right? Unfriend, ignore, or hide. Yeah. I've noticed some people just hiding posts or posts that I've hidden myself. Or confront, which sometimes means adding fuel to the fire. You're jumping into the fray. Isn't that something that should just be done privately?
Well, so that's, you know, and I have to admit, like, that is usually my MO as well, you know, which is like, well, I thought I liked this person. Now I don't. Moving on. Mm-hmm. But on the show, we also talked to DeWitt Campbell. He's a social service worker, a dialogue facilitator for the National Conference for Community and Justice in St. Louis itself. And they actually have created something. It's sort of like a formula with how to talk to people about touchy stuff. And he's said that, you know, he's so interested to see that he actually thinks their formula works better online. So let me just tell you a little bit about it. It's called LARA. It's an acronym. L-A-R-A. So L is for listen, A is for affirm, R is for respond, and A is for add. We have actually a handout for Laura on our website at newtechcity.org. But what I can tell you is that it takes time to be a good interactor. It takes time to not just unfriend, but to engage someone. It is not a quick process. And it also means not reacting in the moment. And what DeWitt told us is, like, that's the beauty of Facebook, though. You can walk away. You can walk away. You can sleep on it and not respond until the next day. So maybe, you know, yes, it's fast on Facebook, but maybe we should be going, like, maybe there should be a slow Facebook movement. I don't know.
So your Facebook friend said something racist. Now what? That was the title of a recent episode of the New Tech City podcast from WNYC. We're talking with Manoush Zamarodi. She got several personal stories and heard from several suggestions and got some data on what to do when somebody says something racist on Facebook, and she's sharing that with us now. But here, I'm thinking about something that you said earlier. That we're living here in New Hampshire, right? And it's a homogenous population. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we're aiming at dialogue. And Facebook gives many of us access to a national conversation or mm-hmm. an international conversation. Should we be even making observations without any experience of that or any context?
Yeah, you know, it's the double-edged sword of social media, right? On the one hand, your voice counts just as much as anybody else's, and that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. On the other hand, we often say things that we haven't really totally thought through or done the research or even considered how somebody else might feel about it. And I think what we're doing and what I hope to really explore is we're in a new world when it comes to dialogue. How do we keep it civilized while furthering the conversation? How do we maintain our humanity while we're all yelling at each other and these ugly, horrible things are popping up? And I think we were just sort of going with it right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's time to like use the most recent news events to sort of pause button here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's just take a minute.
Well, yeah, because unfriending or ignoring means ultimately, that could just have a chilling effect on the conversation, you know, discouraging people from dialogue or sharing their opinion, which we do inside of our own little holiday party gatherings or water cooler conversations about it. Yeah. Facebook is one of the few places we venture outside of the bubble. So how do you nurture conversation and make it helpful?
And, you know, actually, we commissioned a survey from a market research company named Cervata. They polled randomly 300 Facebook users, and almost a third of them said that they considered blocking or unfriending someone over offensive comments about the news in particular. So not only does that mean that, like, yeah, a lot of people are seeing some nasty stuff, but yes, a lot of people are thinking it's time to cut them off. And we had another person on the program, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, and he is a friend of the show and also a black man who has a lot of white friends. He went to a primarily white college. A lot of those people are still. So he was seeing a lot of divisiveness. And he told us that he kind of decided, you know what? I don't unfriend anybody because I want them to all see what each other are posting and then talk about it. He sort of felt, you know, I'm in a unique position of having an extremely heterogeneous Facebook profile. I need to put this to good by educating the white friends who probably have mostly white Facebook how I feel about this. It's my job to tell them. And if I don't, they're never going to know someone who does feel the way that I do.
One of the effects of that is that, you know, yes, you can have those conversations with people who you will not likely see again, who you went to school with, but the others you're going to see at your family holiday party.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is like, yeah, you know, Auntie Jane says something really rude on Facebook and you're going to see her at Christmas dinner. Well, that, I have to say, is where the Laura comes back in. It's time consuming, but the first thing is listening. And even if you think that what the person is saying is absolutely crazy, you have to listen thinking that this is the most wonderful person, the most respected person in my life. I'm going to pretend they are while I listen to what they say, just to get yourself in the mood. Then with Affirm, you find something, anything, anything that you can agree with that Jane says. And maybe Auntie Jane says something like, you know, it's the justice system. We have to leave it to the justice system. And you say, yes, that's what this country was founded on. I agree with you, right? You find that one point. And then you respond. That's the R. You set the tone. You start with that affirmation, and then you start to sort of explain where that has changed and where you find that the justice system maybe went wrong. And then you add facts, statistics, or counter examples. I mean, that means you need to be a well-educated person who does the reading so that you, when you do decide, yes, I'm going to be one of those people to engage in civilized dialogue and try to explain my point of view, that you back it up. You know, we got to back it up. And my guess is that Auntie Jane, if we keep going with this analogy, that she probably doesn't talk like that at the dinner table like mm-hmm. she might in her Facebook feed.
All right. So I'll be carrying both with me to my next log on Facebook and to holiday dinner. Manoush, thank you so much.
Oh, it was such a pleasure, Virginia.
Manoush Zamarodi. She's host of the New Tech City podcast. That's from WNYC. And there's a link to hear the episode, Your Facebook Friend Said Something Racist, Now What?, as well as the Lara handout that she mentioned. All that, wordofmouthradio.org. How about you? Have you seen offensive racist posts on Facebook? Have you unfriended? Have you hid? We'd like to know. Guess where? On our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. Comments and posts tossed off on Facebook can often lead to misunderstandings. Sometimes a simple act of charity can have the same result. When Word of Mouth continues, the story of one man who got more than he bargained for when he signed up to help Santa answer his letters. We'll hear about that bungle after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For many people, the holidays are a perfect time for reflecting on how grateful you are for what you have and for remembering those less fortunate. Scott Gurian's father, Randy Gurian, likes to think of himself as a charitable person, but one Christmas, he got more than he bargained for.
Christmas time doesn't really mean much to my dad. He lives alone, most of his family is out of state, and anyway, he's Jewish. So a few years ago, he got to thinking.
Even though Christmas isn't my holiday per se, rather than just sit around and do nothing, I might as well give back and do some good for people that would like to celebrate it, but they don't have the means to celebrate it.
So he started volunteering at a soup kitchen. He collected donations of winter clothing from his neighbors to give out to the homeless.
And the other thing I do is I go to the post office. They always have letters for Santa Claus, and people could answer them if they want. I pick out the ones that are really the saddest. Kids that are writing letters, and they're asking for clothes, they're asking for shoes, and they say, "And Santa, if you have anything left in your bag, can you maybe get me a shirt?"
My dad usually takes about a dozen or so letters, passes a bunch out to his friends, and keeps a few for himself. Last year, he answered three from kids in the Bronx.
I went to like a discount store, and I try to comply with most of the things on the list. I went to FedEx, I shipped it, and for whatever reason, I put my cell phone number in there, not so much to get a thank you, but just because I wanted to know, I guess, that the packages got there.
Did you write Santa Claus on the return address?
Yes, I did.
And so you shipped it off, and did you kind of think that would be the end of it?
I kind of did, yeah.
It wasn't long before the calls started rolling in.
4:43 p.m.
Hello?
This is Rosicella.
Thank you, I love you.
Thank you for the presents you gave me. I love you. Bye.
Do you remember how you felt when you first started getting these voicemails?
Yeah, I thought that was really nice. It made me feel good that they were happy.
But it didn't stop there.
No, it didn't. It was kind of funny in a way. It went from thank you to kind of almost desperate, menacing phone calls, and the calls were getting more and more frequent.
Can I have a few presents because my mother is broke and I have no presents? Thank you. I love you. Bye. Even though you didn't give me no presents, I still love you. Bye, Santa.
Ooh.
What are your thoughts hearing this again now?
I think they were bringing some of the kids in from outside from the neighborhood because they heard that Santa Claus came.
Was there a point where you started to regret, you know, what you had intended as a charitable act?
I think at some point I regretted putting my phone number down because this one kid was getting more aggressive and more ferocious. I was getting calls like every half hour, every hour.
Santa! Santa! Come on, Santa!
Were you purposely avoiding their calls?
Absolutely. I wasn't going to pick up.
Why?
I think I would have encouraged them more if they would have called. Then they would have asked for many more presents. And after all, Santa Claus only delivers at night. The kids are not supposed to speak directly to Santa Claus. At least when I grew up.
Did this whole experience make you feel any different about being charitable?
Well, while there might be some people that could be scamming Santa Claus, you do it with the idea that hopefully the majority of the people that write these letters are legit and honest, and that's the best way to approach it.
Bye, Randy Curia. I mean Santa Claus.
My dad's decided to play Santa again this year. Last I spoke to him, he had picked three kids' names and was just heading out the door, trying to decide what to get.
Scott Gurian is a public radio reporter living in New Jersey. He spoke with his father, Randy Gurian. Up next, word of mouth drills down into an activity fit for the winter season, ice fishing. The best spots to hook, line, and sinker in New Hampshire are coming up after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Real duck with
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As January approaches, temperatures drop, more snow flies, and lakes and ponds freeze. Well, it may sound like a good time to sit in by a fire. Our next guests urge you to get out into the cold and onto the ice. Dave Kellum and Clay Groves are hosts of the Fish Nerds podcast, which covers just about everything, from hooks to baits to sustainable seafood. And today they're here to talk about ice fishing in New Hampshire. Dave and Clay, welcome.
Hey, we're so happy to be here.
Well, so happy to have you.
It's exciting.
Well, full disclosure, and you may have to revoke my Yankee membership card, but I did grow up in New Hampshire, and I have never been ice fishing.
You are officially invited to come ice fishing with us this winter.
Well, make the case. Why should I? Why should I go subject myself to standing still in the freezing cold?
Well, because you're an NHPR personality. And this is an important part of the culture of your state. And if you don't do it, then shame on you.
Well, that's a good start. Yeah. Why should you do it? Because you should be ashamed if you don't.
I shame everyone into everything. It's kind of my thing.
Well, true. I have to say, I grew up observing ice fisher people, generally men, I'm going to say ice fishermen, yep, as people who just didn't want to be around their families.
Mm. Well, and one of the interesting things is we're taking fishing to the 21st century because a lot of these things are changing, right? And so you're right. The old model is that a bunch of guys got out and it was
lots of beer.
Right, sort of an excuse to go out and drink. Actually, Clay and I don't end up drinking on the ice because we're trying to catch fish. Mm-hmm. And so the experience is changing where one of the traditional things that people used to do is put out traps, which are just these lines on a spool and then a flag pops up. They're mm-hmm. also called tip-ups. Mm-hmm. And that's something that most of your listeners who do ice fish in New Hampshire would be familiar with. But what's interesting is that there's new technology coming out. There's actually sonar that you can look down in the water and see if there's fish around.
Wow.
I know. It makes it so much easier.
Wow.
And it makes it so much more active. And it's the other nice thing about ice fishing is that it's a very social activity, not for the drinking aspect, but because you can actually walk over and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can walk to any of the public waters and drill a hole and fish there. So you can also fish right off the shore of really expensive homes on Winnipesaukee.
Well, that's Dave, by the way. And how do you know what is a public water? I mean, can you go anywhere if it's ice?
Yeah, well, and with New Hampshire, the good news is you can't own water. You can walk anywhere on the water. I have a nice shack that fits on my back, and it pops up into a six-man yurt on ice.
Wow.
So when you come ice fishing with us, you'll come in. We'll have a heater. We'll have a comfortable chair. We'll have sonar. I've got a closed-circuit TV with a camera. I drop underwater. You can see the fish. We're talking modern, fun fishing.
But what happens? Like, it's been a fairly mild winter so far. Any spots frozen over yet?
We've been fishing since – I've been fishing since November 22nd, ice fishing. Twice I've been. Haven't caught any fish yet. It's not a good time of year to go ice fishing. It's a little early still.
Uh-huh.
You want to make sure the ice is 4 inches thick. And the best way I can tell is if someone else is already out there and not dead, then I know it's a good time to go out.
It's a very scientific method.
Are you alive? Yeah. All right. Good. I'm coming.
When does ice fishing season actually get into full tilt then?
On most of the big lakes, it starts January 1st, assuming they're frozen. But whenever your pond, your local pond is frozen to about 4 inches of ice, it's open.
All right, so how do you know when it's exactly 4 inches, other than, you know, seeing someone who's not drowning?
Yeah, you walk out with a chisel and chip a hole.
No kidding.
And just every few feet, take a few steps, chip a hole, and if the chisel goes through really easy, get off the ice.
Okay, so you're giving us the newbie sort of look, okay? Mm-hmm. So I get out there on the ice. What do I do first?
Well, like, you will want to bring something to cut ice. So you either have they're also called spuds, these big long chisels. And there's also an auger, which is just like a big giant mm-hmm. screw thing that's about 6 inches in diameter. So one of the first things you want to do is step out on the ice and drill a hole, punch a hole in the ice and actually measure how much ice you have.
Should you be away from the shore?
A little bit away from the shore. And you want to be doing this every couple of feet. Because falling in the ice is no fun. That mm-hmm. is not a fun thing to do. Clay can attest to that.
I do it at least twice a year.
So just keep working yourself out. And as long as you have that 4 inches of ice, and I usually go with 6 inches ice because I like to have people come up and talk to me. 6 inches ice, you're perfectly safe to be out there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things for newbies, here's a little secret. You want the ice to be noisy. So if you're out on the ice, especially early in the year, you want to hear pops and snaps and things like that. Because what that means is the cold weather is expanding the ice and there's pressure and it's popping and that's good.
Oh, that's interesting because it always creeps me out when I hear that cracking and creaking on the ice.
Oh, and it's a horrifying thing because it defies everything in your nature that says run. That fight or flight response, when you hear that pop, 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 you want to run. Just get off the ice as fast as you can. But actually, that's good noise.
Uh-huh.
Quiet ice, on the other hand,
it's
when it's warming
good.
Up, you won't hear ice melting.
Uh-huh. Right.
But you'll hear it freezing.
Okay. So you talked about like putting these shelters or shanties or huts. I mean, what's the proper word for them?
Both are fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, bob houses is one of my
favorite
Bob
houses.
Ones,
okay. Yeah, that's what I remember hearing growing up. So if you want to put these bob houses out there, 6 inches is okay.
Sure.
But people put, like, stoves in them. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be putting out a big mansion, yeah, I would go thicker than that. Once it gets into 12, 18 inches, which is easily accomplishable in New Hampshire late in the season, people drive cars. Well, Winnipesaukee has a whole festival out.
Well, there's an airport, too.
And they land airplanes. That's right.
In Alton Bay, there's an airport in the wintertime where small planes land on the ice, and there's a little check-in station, and the planes line up and park on the ice.
Wow.
So,
I know.
Yeah.
So thick ice is incredibly strong.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure some engineer out there can cite the numbers on it. So if it's nice and thick and it's cold and not melting, you're great. So, yeah, you can put up these shacks and have no problem with it. And like you said, some people put out really elaborate shacks.
Well, your satellite TV, your what else?
Well, there's a guy in Winnipesaukee who puts out a – he does that. He has a satellite TV. He's got a generator. He's got a hot tub. And so he puts the hot tub out on the ice, fills it with lake water. All run by a generator, and then he sits in the hot tub while he has those flags out on the ice. And when they pop, he runs out in his shorts and bare feet and catches a fish, and then runs back and goes back in the hot tub.
What kinds of fish do you get while ice fishing?
It depends on where you're at. Whatever lake you fish at in the summertime, if you're catching warm water species like bass and sunfish and perch and pickerel, you'll catch those in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
If you want trout and cold water species, you can also get those. So whatever you like, they're there.
And one of the interesting fish is the burbot, which is called locally a cusk. And it's a freshwater species of cod. So just like the cod that are actually in trouble in the Gulf of Maine, there's a freshwater version. And the interesting thing about burbot is that in the summer, they kind of hibernate. You can't catch them in the summer. And you can only catch them in the winter. So that's only an opportunity in ice fishing you could catch these fish.
And where especially do you go for burbot?
Any of the deep, natural, clear lakes. So Lake Winnipesaukee's very good. We've caught them at Newfound Lake. And I think they're in several other lakes as well. They're really good. There are some of the recipes are called poor man's lobster. Mm-hmm. You can kind of boil them in water and vinegar and salt, and they're just excellent.
We're speaking with Dave Kellum and Clay Groves. They're also known as the Fish Nerds, about modern ice fishing in New Hampshire. Not only fun, they say, but apparently very delicious. Okay, so you guys are talking about cooking them. This is not a catch-and-release kind of prospect.
I would say I catch and I release 99% of the fish I catch, just because I like to catch a lot of fish, and cleaning all those would be really difficult. But we do we did a quest a couple years ago to try to catch and eat all of the fish in New Hampshire, because we thought it was something that ought to be done. Mm-hmm. And there's 48 species, and we got really good at eating some of these fish that have never been tried before.
So what was a favorite? Any favorites?
Probably one of the top fish with the
burbot.
It was a burbot. They were fantastic. Yeah, we just boil it in salt water, dip it in drawn butter, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Another really good one is the – this sounds silly, but is the bait that people use. So there's a golden shiner that people use for bait to catch other fish. And because we were on this quest, we had to eat one. And we were very apprehensive when we started all this process because, you know, nobody eats these things. They're surprisingly good. Mm. They're amazingly good. We smoked them, and we could easily see a restaurant, a themed restaurant on shiners, and just a whole bucket of those would be
okay,
great.
Okay, so this may be your next phase of the Fish Nerds.
Maybe.
The Fish Nerds restaurant chain.
We'll see about that. Yes. Wait till you taste what Dave cooks.
Something for us, but it looks like fish-shaped cookies.
Well, it's holiday season, and there's a big Italian holiday coming up, maybe starting already, called the Feast of the Seven Fishes. And so Dave did a take
on that. So the Feast of the Seven Fishes is on Christmas Eve. You create a meal, and I think it's related to Roman Catholic tradition and Lent and those kind of things. And so fish is a big part of that, and they have the Feast of the Seven Fishes, and sometimes it's 9 or 13. I think it's mostly an Italian-American tradition. But you'll see a lot of restaurants, especially in northern Boston, have special menus for the Christmas Eve. But like I said, we're trying to make fishing for the 21st century, so nobody has time to make a feast anymore, right? So I decided to bake 7 kinds of fish in the cookies.
Oh, my goodness.
So in these cookies, we have tuna, salmon, sardines, Acadian redfish from the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of Mexico?
The Gulf of Maine.
He went really far for these.
I'm trying to impress you.
Haddock, sole. And is that 7? Did I miss? It's smelt.
And a nightmare.
Nightmare.
I'm scared to death.
But, Sam Evans Brown has tried one of these. And
he's still walking around.
We assume. I haven't seen him.
I had one of these earlier today. And it's an interesting thing.
They're beautiful. They're actually very appropriately Italian. They are green and red and cookie colored.
Yes. And there's sugar and salt on them.
Okay. I can't really distinguish which fish is which.
Oh, there's each one has all of them.
Yeah. Each one has all 7 in them.
Oh, it's like a monster fish.
Exactly. So,
it's a frankenfish.
So once you take a bite of that, you will have had the Feast of the Seven Fishes.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yes. And then you're done. You don't have to, you know, there's nothing to clean up.
Thank you so much. I'm going to have to bite them while I'm saying goodbye to you, because otherwise I'll just be chewing on the air, really unattractive.
I understand.
Okay, so
oh, they stink.
I have one big question. Like, when do you know when to take the huts in? I mean, I see these bob houses sometimes out there on the ice. At times it looks pretty perilous to me in the spring.
There's set dates. Fishing Game has regulation book out, and they set the dates, and so you know the last day you're supposed to bring them in by. But also, if you're fishing a lot, you should be paying attention to ice conditions. They change a lot through the winter. Ice shanties have been known to get sunk in by the ice. Just sun shines down on them, the ice just opens up, and the shanty sinks in the water. A few years ago, we saw on Winnipesaukee, it was still March, and there was open water for about 100 feet, and on the sheet of ice were ice shanties. And people were going out in rowboats and rowing out there, tying ropes to their shanties, and then tying to a truck, and then driving the truck down the street. And the shanty is just bobbing in the water right to the beach, and some of them just tipped over and sank, and it's... We don't have a hard side shanty. We have pop-up shanties that we bring with us, and we bring off the ice every day. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to worry about
So what do you guys talk about when you're just waiting for the fish? I mean, you guys, I'm sensing that you're kind of shy, quiet, reticent types.
Yes.
We are.
Is that the whole thing, that usually the experience of ice fishing is just talking?
Yeah, well, I usually recite poetry to Clay. I'm a big fan of of more of the Shakespearean stuff. But no, I mean, we talk about all sorts of things. And that's one of the key parts about fishing is the community of folks that you have and in your fishing partners you go out. Clay and I have known each other way too long now. And so we've talked about everything, I think, on the ice, from, you know, how our families are doing to work stuff and all that. So the nice thing about ice fishing, too, is that you have that ability. You don't have an engine going that prevents that. There's a lot of downtime on the ice. but it's also, I don't want to intimidate those introverts out there. There's also plenty of time to just shut up and fish. Hmm. And so a lot of folks will go out alone. I actually go out alone a lot as well. And
he's saying he goes out alone a lot because he doesn't have any friends besides me. So, and we live 70 miles apart from each other, so we rarely fish together. So Dave goes alone because nobody will go with him.
Well, that's true. But anyway, if you find somebody to go with you, you should go with them because that's a good thing.
I think you'll make more friends with these cookies, is my
point. Well, you haven't tried that cookie yet.
If all goes well, you'll be hearing from me again. I'm Virginia Prescott, and Dave Kellum and Clay Gross, the fish nerds, joined me today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dave Kellum and Clay Gross are hosts of the Fish Nerds podcast. You'll find a link to the show as well as a list of their ice fishing tips. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for some proof that the Brits do not have such refined or superior tastes. An expat brings us through the schlocky history of Britain's Christmas number ones. That's after the break, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's face it, Christmas songs can be pretty schlocky. And each year in Britain, a slew of new songs is released in a desperate stab to reach the top of the December charts. Here's actor Bill Nye dishing out the ugly truth in the 2003 movie Love Actually.
But wouldn't it be great if number one this Christmas wasn't some smug teenager, but an old ex-heroin addict searching for a comeback at any price? So if you believe in Father Christmas, children, like your Uncle Billy does, buy my festering turd of a record and particularly enjoy the incredible crassness of the moment when we try to squeeze an extra syllable into the fourth line.
I think you're referring to If You Really Love Christmas.
Come on and let it snow. Ouch.
And it is not just holiday theme songs that reach the top in the UK. Take 2000's winning song, Can We Fix It? By Bob the Builder. Sophie Gilbert is senior editor at The Atlantic and a Brit who has suffered through a series of Christmas number ones. She's here to walk us through the rather tacky tradition. And Sophie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for those who have not seen Love Actually or lived in Britain, what is the Christmas number one?
So the Christmas number one is something that British people have obsessed over, I think, for more than 40 years now. For some reason, every year around this time of year, people get really, really interested and fixated on what song will be number one at the week leading up to Christmas. And I think the first official song that was actually number one at Christmas time was Slade's Merry Christmas, Everybody, in 1973.
So
and then ever since then, we've had a sort of variety of different songs, some good, some bad, some really bad. And it's kind of been up and down since then.
You mentioned in your article about this a memory of a particularly bad Christmas number one from your childhood back in 1993. What was that one?
So in 1993, I was 10 years old, and the winning Christmas number one single was done by not really a children's character, but a sort of novelty character called Mr. Blobby. And he was a 7-foot pink and yellow, I guess a blob. He kind of looked like a bowling pin, He was nonverbal. The only word I think he could really say was blobby, which you'd think would be challenging when you're releasing a single, but apparently not in this case. And he released what gets my vote for possibly the worst Christmas single of all time, a song called Mr. Blobby.
Lyrics?
The lyrics are actually recorded, I think, by a children's choir, and then there are some other singers in there who sing about Mr. Blobby and about why he's, you know, actually a really good star and secretly a hidden talent, and everyone just misses it because he's, you know, known to be an idiot, and the only word he can say is Blobby.
Okay, I listen to this and think, number one song?
I think 600,000 people paid money for it in 1993.
Well, this kind of undoes every American idea about Brits having superior taste.
Yes, and I think really the one thing that the Christmas number one does is reveal that that is actually a myth, that we have very strange, very eccentric tastes sometimes, particularly at Christmas time when there seems to be this great affection for kind of novelty performers like Mr. Blobby and then obviously in 2000, Bob LaBelda.
So what's the deal? Why are Christmas number one so wretched?
It's a very good question. I mean, it's sort of become this thing now where originally I think it was a prestigious thing for a band to get at the Christmas number one, and over the past 10 to 15 years, actually, it's been taken over by The X Factor, which is a British reality show. I think most of the winners during that period have come from that. But there is also this sort of sense now that the Christmas number one needs to be subverted, either by strange acts or by, I think in 2009, there was a social media campaign to have Rage Against the Machine, you know, take the top spot, mm-hmm. which they did. Really in the name of... and this year, in fact, there is a recent campaign by an artist. Well, not really an artist, but he's a professional builder who has released a single under his name, The Wealdstone Raider. And basically, it's this sort of 50-something man rapping about how he has no fans. When I say don't know, you say fans. Don't know fans. Don't know fans. When I say don't know, you say fans. Don't know fans. Don't know fans. Deal with you. Deal with you. You want some? Do you want to deal with me? Deal with you. Deal with you. If you want some. So that's a possible contender this year.
Well, I don't want to sound scroogey about this. I mean, is there any joy at all in anticipating these new Christmas songs?
I think it's fun. I think it's become a part of the holiday tradition. And I think, like I said, we're a kind of eccentric nation and people sort of take joy every year in anticipating the new and strange and, you know, tacky and potentially very odd hits that we might get to listen to.
So it could be that it's so bad that it's good.
Exactly, which again is another very British tradition.
Have you ever liked the Christmas number one, Sophie?
There have been a few that have been actually quite good songs. But I think it's funny, some of the more prestigious and longer lasting Christmas songs seem to have got to the number two spot. I think you had songs like in 1994, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, which is obviously a huge Christmas hit, only managed to get to number two. I think in 1984, Wham's Last Christmas only got to number two. So it seems like, oh, and then in 1987, The Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York, which is a wonderful Christmas song, only got to number two. It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one, and then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune, I turn my face away. So it seems to be, if you want to have a sort of long-lasting impact on Christmas music, that seems to be the spot to get.
Well, you mentioned a late riser for this year, but what else is in the running for Christmas number one 2014?
So for a while, people thought that Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars might be able to take the top spot. This shit, that ice cold, Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Styling, violin. And then unfortunately now, it seems like Ben Hay now, who most recently won The X Factor, is going to be number one on Christmas Day. He seems like he's going to be pretty hard to beat.
So the All-Star Do They Know It's Christmas for updated for Ebola, nowhere in the running?
I mean, it's in the running, but it seems unlikely at this point that it will actually take the top spot. But yeah, I think it's the third iteration of that song. And it's funny, again, because that's a song which sort of everyone seems to groan at every time it plays. But it obviously is a song with a good charitable motive. So, if you want one to buy this year, that might be the good one.
Sophie, are you claiming Christmas number one refugee status now in the U.S.? I mean, you're trying to get away?
It's funny. After I wrote this story and I posted it on Facebook, it's funny how many people I heard from who live in the U.S. now who are sort of like, oh, I miss this tradition. And it is always a fun one every year to kind of just see the horrors that are going to be inflicted upon the British people. But it's a tradition like any kind of tradition. You sort of miss it during the holidays.
Well, thank goodness for the internet is all we can.
Yeah.
Sophie Gilbert is senior editor at The Atlantic. You can find a link to read her story, How Bad Music Became a British Christmas Tradition, and listen for yourself. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today. And as we contemplate bad British Christmas number ones, maybe you have a few bad holiday songs that you loathe. Some in-house contenders, Paul McCartney's Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey, although that one does have a few defenders. And Here Comes Santa Claus. Yep, we're a bunch of Scrooges. Care to add, to defend, to tell us to lighten up? You can post your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. After all, the most annoyingly enjoyable earworms get triggered by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.